Tangent.
That wasn't our normal intro.
No, it wasn't. So I don't want to get off on a rant here, but, you know, it's been a week and a weekend of work. So it's Jack and Coke tonight. What have you got?
I didn't get out and do that shopping that I said I needed to do. So that thing that I didn't drink last week, what did you call it? Butter Tart Deep Pantser?
Yes.
The Dylan's Small Batch Tangerine and Lemon with a Hint of Mint Gin Cocktail.
Okay. So a weaponized depantsinator.
Well, it was this or get into the hard stuff, because that's all I had. I think there might be some wine upstairs, but otherwise it's like bottle of tequila, bottle of tequila.
Why do you have more than one bottle of tequila?
Acquire them over Christmas and I just don't drink them, honestly.
Okay. Sorry, I'm horribly disorganized. I normally play a little bit of some kind of music in the background on my end, just so that I'm distracted from the fuzz of my own breathing. I don't know. I've often thought that we should put some kind of like massively copyrighted music in the background of all of our podcasts, right? Get them deplatformed and demonetized everywhere. You know, is a preemptive strike? Like, here, you can't even pay us.
So you hit me up today asking if we were making enough money that you could quit your job.
Yeah, I did. So, I mean, I don't want to get into it too much because, you know, someday somebody might listen to these. And largely my frustration is just regular, you know, first world job frustrations, but big project, worked lots of overtime, basically, you know, grinding it out because it's late. And some of that is not my fault, but squarely my responsibility. So working all of the overtime. And then today I found out, yeah, customer wants to go in a different direction. So it's like, I've never really liked working. I don't think I want to do it anymore.
Take you out to dinner. Go back to my place and watch Kung Fu. Do you like Kung Fu?
I love Kung Fu.
Actually, I had similar stuff at work today occasionally. Like, we'll get a build that mostly happens like a year ago and then tends to sit when the burden of work falls on the client at a certain point.
Yeah.
Like if content creation and population isn't part of their contract, we'll build the system, you know, everything's in place. They just need to get in and start publishing stuff. And then it'll sit for a year, sometimes more. And eventually they'll either email us on a Wednesday saying, what are the chances we can have this live by end of week? Or as was the case in the past couple of weeks, they've been like, yeah, we're not going to launch this. We're doing something different now, or, you know, it's not applicable to what they're doing. They've pivoted business-wise or whatever. It's very strange.
Yeah. It's shocking to me how much management in, like, everywhere I've ever been, and I don't want to, like, slam anybody for doing this, because sometimes it's just, it's unavoidable, but it really looks just like, it looks like a bumbling vaudeville clown car act sometimes with people. Like, just let's just get started and get something in the go, and we'll get something in the queue, and we'll start working on stuff, and then never finish it and do something else. Like, it makes so much more sense, like, most of the time, to go, what do we really need? Let's make a plan. Let's line it up. Let's see what the finish line looks like and work backwards from there to, oh, we should have started 6 months ago. Okay, well, we're just not going to hit that target. Let's either do something else now or decide that it's fine if it's 6 months after our original goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then recognition that if you plan it out and it's, you know, 6 months from now, chances are it's going to take you 9 months or a year or more. I don't know. I don't own my own company. I don't run my own company. I guess there's a reason for that. Just don't have enough money to throw at the problem. So if you'd like to send us a dollar, the address, you just put it in a self-addressed stamped envelope and send it to, all right, I can't do that. That's fraud. I feel like I should probably have taken some Ritalin. right? I've got that hyperactive, just because I've been stressed for 3 weeks, right? Yeah. Where it's just, and today it's like, it's just all going away. So I have that seesaw of, I have lots of energy, I need a nap.
So to set up kind of where we're at, we just recorded two episodes. I guess it was a little more than a week ago now. Just released the first one a couple days ago is the time of recording this. And you hit me up. You're like, hey, do we want to record early this week? I'm like, sure, no problem. Throw some dates. And you're basically like, how about tomorrow? Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, do you have anything you want to talk about? No. Not really. You said yeah. We just had our D&D session. I have some questions about that. But otherwise, no. Put up a show doc. Neither one of us put anything in it. And we're just like, hey, that's cool. We'll have a tangent episode. We'll just start talking and we'll stop when we're done.
I mean, yeah. So buckle up. This could be 6 or 7 days worth of recording.
This is going to be one of those therapy episodes, isn't it?
Oh, man. So then in third grade, you know, the teacher used to always give me the hard clay. And I felt really bad about that because, you know, I wanted to be a sculptor, but you can't do that because it's not financially viable to do that. So, you know, and then the crayons were the wrong color. Also, what's with the flesh colored crayon? First of all, right, if it's supposed to be skin color, then wow, that's racist. But it says flesh colored, or at least it did on the packs of crayons that I got when I was a kid. And I don't know about you, but, you know, I've had some reasonably serious cuts and my flesh doesn't look like that. Flesh is kind of pink, unless you're bled out, in which case it's gray. Don't ask me how I know that.
I'm just going to roll the table talk stinger.
Oh, man. I've had like 2 sips of drink, and it sounds like we're on episode 2 of the recording tonight. So we played D&D.
We did. We ran your game on Sunday. I had a game on Tuesday. I think both sessions were a lot of fun.
I was really surprised actually by our game last night, because I have some stuff sort of prepared, but it's mostly sort of, you know, middle in the future kind of things, mm-hmm. right? Like I have a few little bits of like stick these in where they fit sort of encounters, and a whole bunch of like strategy documents also almost. And I wanted to play yesterday because next weekend is Easter and we're not going to play on Easter. And I'm like, I don't want to skip 2 weeks in a row. I'm not really prepared. That thing on the bridge, I literally threw together about 20 minutes before we started.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had a plan for it. It fit story-wise, like the story elements were supposed to be there. And I thought, okay, I warned everybody before we started, this is likely to be a shit show. I haven't prepared. I'm exhausted. I'm stressed. I can't think right. My brain is mush. And then I thought it went really well.
It went great.
I almost killed you.
I've learned, honestly, that some of the best sessions I've ever done in complete hindsight aren't the ones that I did a lot of planning for. I mean, I've had some ones that have really come together where it's, you know, like I'm trying to anticipate how the group is going to do it. And I'm accounting for different sort of possibilities and everything clicks together and it comes out fantastic. I've had sessions that were like the one you ran where it's like, I don't know, we're just going to do something. Hey, I've got a map. I'm going to put something on it. Mm-hmm. You guys show up here. Stuff happens. And those have turned out great. And then I've had sessions where not only was it entirely theater of the mind, but like we didn't move to any new set pieces. You guys woke up this morning and what do you want to do? And let the players drive it. And some of those have been the best sessions that I've ever participated in. Now, I think we have to get to a certain point with like character development where there's sort of the rapport and people can kind of have shared experiences and war stories and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to rack up our war stories now in your group. Tanya's playing that up a little bit now that she's switched over to the bard,
mm-hmm.
Which is nice to see. But no, that was a great session. You know, nothing that moved plot a ton, but like we were all engaged and pretty busy. It was combat heavy. We had a couple of encounters. Yes, I've very much learned that you don't look at challenge rating at all.
I do, but I don't. It's not gospel because if you look at it like mathematically, I knew that the challenge rating of that encounter was too high. But at the same time, it was like, you know, strategically, generally, you guys work it out pretty well.
Yeah, it is certainly better to aim a little bit high because, I mean, you know, it's clear that like you're not putting a bunch of pieces on the board and then optimizing your play for all of them as DM. It's like, okay, you've moved through this, you know, there's a group of, was it three mobs initially when we were on the bridge, and you let us get through a couple of ones, and then this guy appears and shanks me in the back, basically one-shots me. There's another guy in the hopper in case, you know, we need to stretch this out a little bit more, but you're managing the difficulty. You're not always doing the optimal thing when it's your monster's turn, right? You are managing difficulty, even though it was like a CR8. So we ended up with, I don't remember what those bearded dudes were. I think they're like CR3 or something each.
Something like that. Yeah.
And then a pair of CR8 assassins. And we are a party of five level 3 characters with a little extra juice.
Yeah.
You know, we've got some extra abilities and some homebrew stuff going on that amplifies our capabilities a little bit. So you have to aim a little bit high, but no, we made it work. You did the smart thing at the end there where it's like, okay, the outcome of this encounter has been determined. I've only got one guy left. His health pool was probably still reasonably high at that point, but it's like, oh, he slips and he falls off the bridge or whatever. It just saved 3, 5, 8 minutes of, okay, it's my turn. I hit the guy. Okay, my hit.
Yeah.
You know, whittling him down when the outcome has been determined. We've talked about that before. I thought you handled that well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought it was thematically appropriate. Also, Tanya had asked previously, hey, does this damage the bridge? And I'm like,
she did.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it makes sense that, yes, it sometimes it might. But, I mean, the first one that she did, she rolled really low on damage. And I thought, it's not the appropriate time. But it was a nice dramatic way to finish it. He was nearly dead. Like, it was, yeah. It was one round away from being over. So there's I was really, really frankly impressed with how well that went. You guys did pretty well. The only thing that I would note, and it's something that I see in every kind of cooperative game, right, is that there's a little bit of competition for who puts up the biggest damage numbers. Mm-hmm. It's not overt. And it's not a bad thing either. It's a little bit of player engagement where like, I really want to roll good, right? Where at the beginning, and to be, if you saw the recording of the screen from my place, when you moved the first time in the first round of combat and said, I get a little distant, you parked yourself right next to the invisible assassin.
Perfect.
And I'm like, well, I wasn't going to bring these guys in unless there was a little bit of extra tension required. And then I thought, you know what? This is just too perfect.
No, and it was great. I didn't mind, like, sometimes players take it personally when they get downed. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, now I got to wait for somebody to get me up, or, you know, I'm rolling death saves or whatever. And I actually liked, because I am one of those players that at least at this point in our power curve is putting out insane damage.
Yeah.
That's going to change because, like, I am now what I am basically until, you know, level 12. I think my Hunter's Mark damage is going to go up incrementally, but if I'm playing the way I've built that character to play with the hand crossbows and that feat, like, it's meant to be beefy now and
sort of not get much stronger.
Yeah, I'll get outpaced pretty quickly, and I'm totally fine with that. But it was nice in that I got to, hey, I was downed and then I was up, and Chris opted only to give me a single hit point, which was cool because then I played defensively, right? Like, when's the last time you volunteer in combat to take a dodge action?
That's the first time I've heard it. That's literally the first time I've ever heard it. But I mean, it makes sense. It also sort of pointed out to me that the party doesn't have a whole lot of healing, which most of the time is not an issue in fifth edition.
Nope.
Right? It's fine. Having a backup cleric, but I mean, you have, like, there's you, cause you have sort of quasi healing spells, right?
Nope.
No, you don't. you can have, like, it's possible.
Yeah, as I gain a little bit more, because I literally just got my first level of Gloomstalker, right? So
okay. Oh, all right. Yeah, okay.
As I hit level 4, I haven't gone through that yet to see what I'm going to be getting next level, but I think some utility stuff probably makes sense. I'm going to see what Tanya wants to take with her bard too. Right. I don't know how much she wants to lean into the utility stuff.
Who knows? I mean, if she's going swords bard, it sort of strikes me that she's likely to go more combat focused, and that's
fine. I think so.
But I mean, bards get access to healing spells. Mm-hmm. You know, paladins have access to healing spells. In theory, rogues can have access to healing spells if they take the arcane, whatchamacallit, the trickster thing, right? Not a lot of healings, but little bits of things, right? But it strikes me that I'm probably going to, you know, something like, oh, you find a cache of potions just in case you need them.
We had a nice Baldur's Gate 3 moment at the same time during that encounter.
Yep.
Our minds were aligned.
Yes. You're fighting on a bridge and some of the railings have been taken down. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to forego my attack this round to try and shove someone off. And then Rich threw out silvery barbs, which was perfect.
It was great.
Yeah. It's exactly what that's for. It's like, here's a critical role for an athletics check to shove someone off a bridge for... Now we're going to have to do some kind of a rescue because it's 100 feet down into the water.
I'm glad you said that you were thinking it, because I thought I put it out into the ether myself. Oh, so to back up for some context, one of our players moved her character into position right on the edge of this broken part of the bridge. Mm-hmm. And she was moving to engage one of the monsters. And we keep sort of a Discord chat going alongside our VTT gameplay. And it's usually just GIFs constantly, memes in the middle of our session. And I just post a random meme, just whatever I got out of Giphy, typing shove as a search query, right? Playing Baldur's Gate 3, it's all about the shove. And she didn't take the bait. She just, you know, barbarian whack whack, which was totally fine. But then you went next, and it appeared from my perspective that, oh, the DM took the bait and he rolled double crits.
Yep. Yeah. So even with disadvantage, it's a crit either way. Yeah. And then I re-rolled it, and I think I rolled like a 4 and a critical fail. So yeah, no, it was a good thing. I had a chat with Cindy afterwards, actually, just to let her know, like, hey, there's, you know, like you can forego an attack for trip or shove, which you can. I think I'm gonna house rule shove a little bit as well. I think I'm gonna do the because it's by the rules as written, when you take the shove action, you can move a creature 5 feet. Mm-hmm. And I think Baldur's Gate 3 has gone a little bit overboard with the accentuating the shove distance, right? Where if you have like a 23 strength or something, you can shove someone off map, you know, like that person went 73 miles.
Yes, that's not 5e rules as written. That's for sure.
No, and shove is a bonus action, which also isn't rules as written. Works great in the game. In Baldur's Gate 3. So I think I'm going to do some kind of a house rule where however much you beat the other person's roll by adds another foot. So it's like 5 feet plus, you know, and then it goes in sort of 5 foot increments. So if you shove somebody and they go 9 feet, they go 5 feet. Mm-hmm. But if they go like 11 feet, then they go
10.
Yeah.
Yep. That makes sense. Little subtle stuff. Listen, I'm not going to tell any other player how to play. You enjoy the game you want, you know, the way you want to enjoy it. But there is more enjoyment to be had. And you don't have to get nerdy and crunchy about it, but just starting to think about some things tactically and using some of the other tools in your tool belt. Mm-hmm. You know, we're playing with a VTT, so you've got a map and a grid in front of you. You can think about positioning and like shoving somebody off of a bridge is a pretty epic sort of narrative moment in combat versus, I smack him with a sword, or I smack him with the bagpipes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm going to have to do that 3 or 4 more times until I've finished this guy off.
Yeah.
Or, sploosh.
Yeah. And maybe they're out of combat, and maybe they swim to shore and come back at the end of combat.
Yeah.
Like, who knows? Like, there's all kinds of different ways to do it. There are some things about the combat that I'm throwing at you that I think is, I think everyone has missed, and I'm totally okay with it, because it's going to be the kind of thing that there'll be some kind of climactic story moment, like 2 or 3 years from now, which, if anyone remembers, you know, like this session and sessions like it, they're going to go, oh my God, I didn't realize that. I hope. It may not be 2 or 3 years, probably more likely 3 or 4 months, but still. Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's like our Curse of Strahd campaign, it might be 2 or 3 years.
I mean, it could be. That went on for a really long time. There's such a variation in how, and it's funny to me. One of the reasons that I was thinking about this the other day, that I don't really like running games in established settings, is because I can never remember all of the stuff that I'm supposed to know, right? It's like, we're in Daggerford. Well, in Daggerford, you know, the local law is such and such. I'm like, sake, can't remember all that. I can barely remember if I'm supposed to take the garbage out today or not.
Yeah. I don't run a lot of canned material, but when I do, I make it clear that I don't want to be bogged down by the baggage. Like, I'll take the important parts. This is what Daggerford is. Yeah, here's where it is on the map. That's enough.
It's a town.
I will sort of impose my own headcanon on top of it at that point. I don't need to bury where, well, actually, that is run by a council of lords.
Oh my God, who cares? Yeah. Well, it depends. Like, for some people, I'm sure that's really important. Like, I've seen or read stories of people who run like political intrigue and mystery type campaigns. And I'm like, I would love to do that. I am completely incapable of doing that.
Mm-hmm. But even in situations like that, like, I'm not going to say I don't care about that idea. What I don't care about is what the established canon is for that.
Oh, yeah, fair.
I found in my game, now I have a couple of players that in my Tuesday game play a lot of D&D. So I go out of my way to make sure they understand that you might recognize some names. You might recognize some places. Sometimes I'll pull like named NPC characters in. I'm just using them because I like the token art, or I like the name, or their stat block kind of aligns with what I want to do. But if their name is an ass, I won't bother renaming them. And I just have to remind them, look, you maybe have played a game that had this character in it. This is not that character. Don't, you know, it's one thing to run into like what you're doing with your game, where you're pulling out characters that are just, you know, default stat blocks essentially. And I'm like, oh, I know that. That's probably a CR 7 or 8, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and then having, oh, this was a plot crucial character, and I remember them, and they were, you know, a backstabbing bitch or something like that from Tomb of Annihilation. And I'm like, no, everything's made up. It's all a figment of my own imagination, and whatever story hooks you guys give me to flesh out and build off of. Do not read between the lines on anything, because I'm going to disappoint you.
Yeah.
So I'll run that intrigue and that sort of espionage type thing, but it's going to be my material, not, you know, so whatever the established lords of Candlekeep are, whatever, I don't care about that. Welcome the new lords of Candlekeep.
Yep.
Hookers and blackjack.
Oh, where the lords are made up and the books don't matter. Yeah, so tell me about your Tuesday game.
So I mentioned last time we talked about tabletop stuff that I was taking them through a dungeon crawl for the first time, really, since our campaign started, and I'd thrown a puzzle at them. And the fallout from that was fantastic. I don't need to rehash that, but they did continue through this dungeon. And I've been able to milk some of the juiciest dungeon crawl experiences out of them. And it has been equally fantastic. One of the reasons that I wanted to do the dungeon crawl is that I have a rogue in my party, and she, I don't want to say she takes being a rogue seriously, but she takes the identity of her character seriously, and that's part of it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I've been doing is fairly cinematic and like high drama and personal stakes. And, you know, every one of the characters is kind of intertwined with the story now, and they all have, they've all been pulled together where their stories start to overlap. But mechanically speaking, I haven't always taken the time to cater to everyone. So to get a rogue into a dungeon where she's lock picking like a boss, and she's checking for traps and doors and some of that stuff, it's great. Like, it gives her a chance to actually be a rogue, and she's enjoying it. And I'm enjoying what happens, because I mean, this happened with us in some of the games that you ran. She starts off like, ooh, there's a door, I'm going to pick that lock, but before I do, I'm going to check for traps. I want to listen to see if I could hear anything on the other side. And that goes on for, you know, 10, 15 doors. And then she gets a little bit cocky. Or the first time one of the other characters is like, actually, I found a hidden door over here too. Do you want to come check it out? She, you know, doesn't go through her usual steps. And like, I didn't make it up. The intention was something was always going to happen when you open that door unless you checked for it. And she like gets her face half melted off by steam.
The kobold gets cut in half.
Yeah, she, which was great. Like, she just finished saying 5 minutes ago as a character, in character, even though they're running into spike traps and near death all the time, she's like, I'm having the time of my life. This is, you know, what I always dreamed of. And now my eyeballs are boiling. It's been fantastic. And I got to give it to them as players too, because they've gotten really good at reading me as a DM and recognizing the things that I've put in there that are meant to lead to the fun shit. So at the end of this first level of this dungeon, there's this big room, and the basic setup of it is they'd already run into something that was kind of a water trap, where there was this big metal grate that they had to walk across instead of floor. And if they didn't check it, it basically just pivoted and flipped over, trapped them underneath it, priming them for what was to come. They walk into this big chamber, big metal grate, water underneath everything, couple of open spots that are cut out on the far sides. And they're like, oh, this is going to be fun. They go in. There's a big lever in the middle of the room, a locked door on the far side. As players, as DM, I mean, it's obvious. Oh, we pull that lever and shit's going to go sideways, right? That door is going to get locked. This room's going to fill with water or something stupid, or big monsters are going to jump out at us. Or in my case, all of the above. And where they're willing to take a random door in a random part of the dungeon and hyperanalyze it, be like, nope, we're not going to open it. I'm going to check it for traps. I'm going to listen for what's on the other side and try and peek underneath it. They see that lever and they're like, oh, we're pulling it. This is obviously meant to set up the next thing. I've telegraphed that, like, there really isn't anything else to do in here. You could probably try to cheese it, but that's less fun than pulling that lever, having the room fill up with water, you know, the tension and danger kind of raised. And they're going to have a couple of like pretty high level basilisk type characters that were kind of in this pool of water underneath come out at them. They were just basically poking their heads out of the water where we left off last session. But it was great. Like, no hesitation at all. Nobody in the party questioned it. They're like, well, maybe I won't stand by the lever when I pull it. Maybe we'll all just stand over here and I'll use my mage hand, give it a tug. And I'm like, okay, so you're pulling the lever? Oh, yeah. Click. Bars drop down out of the ceiling from the entrance that you came in. The door that you're all huddled beside that you know is locked, and you know, because I telegraphed the type of locking mechanism it is based on the door that they came through, they know they can't pick it. They need to figure out whatever they need to do in this room to open it. They're like, well, we'll stand by this door just in case it opens, but yoink. You know, none of this, well, we could swim down and try and figure out what the lever does. None of the, well, maybe we can bypass the lever.
It's so funny. Like, that's so quintessentially Dungeons and Dragons, where it's like, you know, you're walking along and say, hey, there's birds singing in the trees, and you see a squirrel run down the trunk of the tree, and you're like, let's interrogate the squirrel, right? And let's try and figure out what the significance of the squirrel is. I really want to make a character and call it Significant Squirrel just because of that.
Who do you work for?
but you come to an obvious trap and you're like, yeah, I spring the trap, whatever. It's, like, there's so much imbalance between those two positions, and yet
it makes the game wonderful.
It does. I mean, they're great experiences. It's just, it's funny if you look at it from the outside and go, what are you people, stupid? And we all are sometimes. I remember, I have a story, a D&D story. I was playing a character, which if you've ever read any of Terry Pratchett's book, I based him on the character, the early character, Carrot Iron Founderson. Who is, have you ever read the Terry Pratchett stuff?
Discworld?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read a couple of the Discworld books way, 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 way back. It's the only Pratchett I've read.
It happens in Discworld. It happens in Ankh-Morpork, which is the greatest name for a city ever. But the general conceit is that Carrot is named Carrot because he has red hair and he's shaped like a carrot. Broad shoulders, narrow hips, you know, really tall, but he's a dwarf. Not genetically, but he was raised by dwarves. His family is dwarven, so he's a dwarf, even though he's like 6'6". Mm-hmm. But he's not dumb, but he's very innocent when he comes to the city, right? And he joins the city watch, and he's like, oh, we need to clean things up. And in fact, anyway. So I was playing this character who I named Carrot. I was a big dumb fighter. And I was walking through the marketplace, and somebody handed me, this was back in second edition days, somebody basically said, hey, I've got a job for you. And I was like, yeah, I'm not interested, right? The DM is basically handing me, I have a quest for you. Here's a quest. And I'm like, I don't trust you. And then somebody else tried to hand me something, and I'm like, I can't read, right? And it was just, I guess you kind of had to be there, but at the same time, it was just like the character being so dumb and the DM just looking at me and going, I can't, how do you, like, how do I even, why are we doing this? I remember just, and this was with a group that we didn't really role play much, right? Mm-hmm. Back in the days when everybody was just a little bit too self-conscious to do any kind of voices or actually act in character. Right. And the rest of the party's just like, he's like, you can bring the paper back to us. We can all read. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not interested.
Yeah. My players are the opposite of that. They are absolutely in on role playing tangents. To give you a perspective, because there's a lot that's gone on in my game that I haven't talked about in this, and it's fine. I don't want to get it bogged down. But the hilarious sort of contrast between what you would expect and what actually happens in my game couldn't be more stark. So I think I set it up before that I brought them into the Shadowfell. It's like, you know, they're crossing over into Mordor. The danger's going to ramp up. And they've had some pretty deadly encounters getting to this city that I've established, Rakmaloth. And, you know, it's your typical sort of city of shadows, city of the night. It's in the Shadowfell. Danger, bad shit going on. This is the bad guy's stronghold in this sort of mini arc that they're on. Not so mini arc, because it's been going for almost a year now. And they get their way in through the gates. You know, they come up with a scheme, bluff their way in through the gates. That takes two sessions to get through that after some shit that happened outside. They get into a market in the game, and they're just trying to sort of get the lay of the land, figuring out where they're going to stay, figuring out things like, well, if we need to buy anything, like what kind of money do we need? And they get to this market, and one of the players just says something offhand, right? 10 sessions before, they were in the Feywild, and we just did this offhand joke about, like, psychedelic mushrooms, right? It turned into, like, 2 seconds of a character getting really, really fucked up before we moved the story on. Mm-hmm. And they saved some of those mushrooms. And 10 sessions later, they're in the middle of this tense situation, and there's like, well, maybe I can give this person some mushrooms and trade it for some goods or some money or try and get information. And one character said, did you do anything to preserve those mushrooms? And I picked up on it like this, and it's just, no, it was like mushroom slime. super, super potent, like absorb through the skin. We ended up having a whole session where two of the players were just fucked up beyond all recognition in in the middle of the street in this shadow city while the others are scrambling, trying to figure out to deal with this situation, right? Bad people are patrolling and coming in their direction, and these people are just, it's kind of like the, you watched Vox Machina, right? The animated?
The first two seasons, if that's where we're at.
So, you know that scene where they go to their version of the Feywild and they're fighting some monster that like shoots spores at him, and Keyleth and I don't know, the one character is named the sister.
Oh yeah.
Get all fucked up, and they're, you know, picturing Trinket sort of all sexy and stuff.
I remember that. Just
a,
yeah.
It's like a 3-second scene, right? It's kind of funny. This played out for 3.5 hours. They finally wrap that up. They get the information they want. They find this inn, which I'm reusing the map from the inn that I'd set up for you guys, set up for the night. And then by next session, we were just going to have it around the inn prepping because one of the players was gone. It turned into burlesque, a performance, trapeze, one of our characters in drag. It was, you know, this is just the way they roll. And that took up a whole session.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. It's easy for me, right? Because then if I don't have a lot prepped, I can just let them go off and they will go off.
It's nice when that happens. It's rare, too, that it happens in an online game, because I've had sessions that I've been part of in person where like people are just sort of riffing off of each other for long periods of time, just making shit up. Although it's been rare in my experience, because I think I've mentioned before I learned to play D&D with some war gamers. Mm-hmm. So they're all about tactics and rolling the dice, so there's not a lot of sort of in-between combat stuff that happens that isn't either buying and selling your stuff or prepping for combat.
Yep.
Or recovering from the previous one, but it is super nice when it happens.
Yeah. And I mean, let's be honest, two of my players have their vector into D&D came through things like Critical Role. Mm-hmm. They're the younger of my two players. They're not young, believe it or not. All my players are like 30 and over. Oh. But
they've got it from the acting perspective as opposed to from the game perspective, almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they're very much, you know, like D&D 5th edition plus what a lot of people think of as Dungeons and Dragons now because of things like Critical Role, Acquisitions Incorporated and stuff like that is very much for them. Like they would never survive in 4th edition or maybe even 3.5 or Pathfinder 1st edition. Like you would have to work hard to make enough room in any session that included combat, right? You'd have to work hard to make enough room to allow them to inject that stuff. Because otherwise, well, you know, we're in combat with three goblins and it's going to take 7 hours before we're done.
Fourth edition kind of gets a bad rap. I think I was watching, so there's two, this is a segue into fourth edition rant, which is fine. Fourth edition kind of gets a bad rap because it was a reaction to the things that people didn't like about D&D up to that point. Mm-hmm. And we may have covered this before, but like in first edition and second edition, like there was no attempt at balance. Nope. It was, what is a fighter like? What is a wizard like? What is a rogue like? Mm-hmm. And how does that progression happen? And it looks about like this, right? And then everything else was left sort of to the DM to go, I need to give you stuff to do. And we didn't have a whole lot of examples of that. So it was made up. And if your DM was talented or had a lot of experience, then it was great. And if not, then not so much. Wizards were very unpopular, which for some settings actually makes a lot of sense, right? If you think about it, right? Like now it's like, why wouldn't you be a wizard, right? You get cantrips at will. Like I can firebolt all day long and never actually use a spell slot unless we meet the big bad. Back in the day, it was like at level one as a wizard, you cast magic missile and then you were done for the day. Like you were useless at that point. And like I like the way that fifth edition has sort of has done that, right? It's not perfect. Nothing ever is. fourth edition was an attempt to balance everybody. And the unfortunate result of that is that everybody was the same mm-hmm. with slightly different flavoring.
Yeah, it was basically like, what if World of Warcraft, but much slower because it's tabletop.
And with VTTs, I think that that would probably go much quicker, because a lot of the problem with fourth edition was trying to keep track of what was going on, right? This affects that, affects this, affects that. It would be wonderful as a video game. Like a fourth edition video game would be fine.
I would go so far as to say that like D&D fourth edition is a better game than yes. fifth edition.
Agreed.
It is not a better shared activity.
I would agree with that. One of the things about second edition that I kind of miss is that power imbalance, right? Because there was a lot more crossover. Like you mentioned in our game, like the character that you're playing comes online really early, but then doesn't develop all that fast from there on. And like in first and second edition, the way that character was the fighter, like at level one, a fighter was the most powerful thing that you could possibly be. You had the best armor class, you had the most hit points, you did the most damage. Wizards were basically useless. Round about level five, six, everybody kind of leveled out a bit. Rogues were starting to drop off at that point because there was really not much left for them to do. But wizards were starting to come online. And by the time that you reached like level 8 or 9, you were epic level adventurers, and the wizards were altering the state of the world. And fighters were like, I punch a thing. So yeah.
I think fifth edition found the sweet spot for the most part, where there are definitely still times where characters feel like superheroes, you know, mm-hmm. they're supposed to tickle that same impulse, that same desire as being a superhero does. But at the same time, it's very rare that characters... Wow, that is very loud on the microphone.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. I added all of that shit out every time because it's just like... It's okay. I'm not... It's fine. it's just very loud. Fifth edition is good at not having characters feel useless.
Yes.
Except in the moments where it is appropriate. Like I look at me last session down, and then I have one hit point. And what am I going to do? Go get in the face of one of these things? No,
that's a bad idea.
I don't feel useless. I feel on the defensive. I feel threatened. And that's good. I'm not bored. It's, oh, I can't just go hit it. I'm just going to end up down again. I'm going to use a dodge action. I'm going to disengage. I'm going to put myself in a position where I'm using my companions as meat shields in front of me.
Well, and to be fair, like I was thinking about this actually as I was putting those assassins into that map, is Shane is going to move off to the side and be a ranged combatant, and he's absolutely massacring the battlefield, and I have to counter that.
Perfect.
Like, not with a, I have to shut down the thing that makes you cool, because that's dumb.
No, but situationally change the balance of combat does a couple of things. One, it forces me to adapt and enjoy a different type of gameplay. Two, it shines a spotlight on other players. I'm playing on the defensive, so now they're stepping up to the plate and doing some awesome stuff, and I'm 100% on board for all of that. Uh-huh. I've been trying to do that a little bit even without the sort of prompting. Like our last encounter there, I was just like, man, I don't feel good about attacking this guy. We gave him a chance to surrender. Everybody else just keeps going to town on this poor hobgoblin, and I'm just like, nah, I'm going to ready an action, but I don't think I'm going to do anything because I don't feel like the murder hobo.
Yeah.
I'm learning that everybody else in our party is murder hobos.
They are a bit, and that's okay.
Totally fine.
I'm much more accustomed to dealing with players like that. It's much easier to set things up for players like that, right? Like, it's a little bit difficult because if you remember when you first met Matthew and Mock, right? Chris was basically like, oh yeah, this guy's bad. I'm going to beat him up. Right. And this time he was like, I'm going to try and get on your good side.
I got to tell you, I'm really enjoying, like, we've talked about enjoying Chris doing the awkward leadership thing.
Yes.
I'm really enjoying him being the worst paladin in the world.
says that too. Yeah, no, he's absolutely nailing that role.
Like, how many deception rolls did he roll that last session? Like four?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And I get where he's going with it. He's basically like...
Oh, no. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. I was going to mention, I was going to sort of talk to the rest of you guys about... and I don't know if I should say this out loud, because I don't know if he listens to these. I mean, it's not a secret or anything, but getting you all of everyone else to sort of push him into the leadership a little bit. Not so much to say, you know, you need to make the decision, but this is what I think. What do you think, Corwin? Right? Just because I think there's two things. Number one, he's just so good at that awkward leadership thing.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, I just think it makes the group dynamic really good. Like, I don't want to push anyone to do something they don't want to do.
No, no.
But it's a suggestion where I'm like, if you guys think this would be fun, I think you should do it.
Yeah, and I got to be cognizant of that too, because we're at the point where, oh, Bug's talking now, and I don't just want to revert back to being Dex, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know what? Honestly, I think that you've made a pretty good transition into that too, because when it first started, like you talked a lot, and then I've noticed it tapering off as it goes along, which makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. The character hasn't talked for umpty years. He's probably got a lot to say. And then is sort of going back to, you know what? I don't really like talking all that much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, I was surprised, pleasantly surprised by how well everything went yesterday. Because it's one of those things where you think, like, this is either going to be awesome or it's going to be awkward and slow. And we got most of the way through that first combat. And I'm like, holy crap, we've been playing for 2.5 hours.
And that's a nice thing about D&D. Like, honestly, as long as we've all got something to do, we're having fun. The only time it really bogs down, I think, for anybody is when the spotlight shifts to somebody doing something and they're just a passive observer for a long length of time.
Yeah.
Like, going back a couple sessions ago, even when I prompted, like, hey, this is taking a while, this shit that me and Tuft are doing. Meanwhile, back at the inn.
Yeah. It's tough, especially when, like, even when the party is together, but you split the party narratively,
mm-hmm.
right? It becomes difficult. There's also, depending on players too, right? And this is something that I recognize I'm not real great at, is sort of tailoring the experience to the individual player,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I'm really good at reacting to people doing stuff, but if someone is sort of a more passive voice in the group, I'm not as good at sort of drawing them out, right? I have a little bit of difficulty sometimes with Chris, just because he's on the quiet side, right? So I want to make sure that he has stuff to do and that he's having fun,
mm-hmm.
but it's tough to judge when you're not in the room and he's quiet. So one of the reasons I actually wanted to push him into that leader role is I like to hear from him, because he's a great role player and I just want him to do more of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, as more of the character comes out, like we talked about last session, the personal stakes and the personal motivations, and the more you can appeal to that and like reel something, you know, oh, you haven't really been talking much this session and I recognize it. Zzz, here's something related to your personal backstory.
Yep.
You know? Usually it's a gut punch a lot of the times, right? That's usually what works.
Mm-hmm.
Or some sort of flipping expectations on their head as it relates to that kind of thing. I've found it with my players, at least, it brings them right back in. Like when you feel somebody's just kind of not tuning the game out, but a little bit disconnected or disengaged.
Yeah, taking a back seat, kind of.
You know, enjoying it passively.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of putting it, because I think that's really a lot of what is there's this weird thing where, like, I'm involved in this story, but at the same time I'm listening to the story,
mm-hmm.
right? And then it comes time for you to sort of make your injection into the story, and sometimes for some people it's like, well, now I don't know what to say.
One of the things that you did in our Strahd campaign and what became the Hub adventure, And I've done something similar in my game, kind of modeled off of that, is that that trope of them almost having patrons, mm-hmm. or something that they're championing, something that, you know, at any point in the game I can just drop in, and whether it's an exposition dump, whether it is, you know, just a conversation that's meant to reel them back in. We talked about how one of my characters is sort of this weird relationship going on with the Raven Queen, as an example, right? And some of the weird stuff that's been going on there. So in almost any situation, I can now bring a Raven in. Like, you notice a Raven standing there, you lock eyes, you're pulled into, you know, your own memories or the Raven Queen's memories. And we have this hot moment. It doesn't need to last any more than about 3 minutes, because the other players become a passenger at that point, but you can do a really good job of, like, you leave that player that was disengaged breathing heavily at the end of that short little thing, right? Mm. You did a pretty good job of that with the stuff that was going on in the Curse of Strahd campaign, where we had the dragon thing that was going on with Dulcimer, and the druid stuff that you'd kind of set up with Plo, and of course I had Lena and my sword thing, right? Mm-hmm. You're starting to plant the seeds of that in our game. You know, I'm hearing some, not hearing voices, but feeling some presences. You've already had this dragon talking to Chris's character. I think if you can get something like that set up with the other characters, that you can just,
yep,
just drop it in when you need a splody something, right? Like, just,
oh yeah, it's all there. It's all there for everybody. It's, yep, all the seeds are sort of planted. There's some secrets. Rich, like, dropped some of the secrets that he had about, you know, being able to see magical auras, mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff. And you talked a little bit about the dream that you had. And Corwin talked about the dream that he had. I actually had intended for everyone to have a dream at that point, but as previously mentioned, I was absolutely swamped with work, so I only got two of them done. So the rest of them will sort of, you know, dribble in as time goes on. Cindy was actually a little bit disappointed, because she did a little narrative thing where, you know, like, I've grown a snout and a tail, and everybody was just like, eh, whatever.
She's done it before, though. It isn't the first time we've seen it, so.
I know, but it's still, like, even then, it basically went over, like, that's just normal. Is it? I don't know. Maybe she's not being dramatic enough about it, but there's this kind of, this is another one of those D&D tropes where, you know, I grow horns and a forked tail and hooves and I smell like sulfur, and then it goes away and everybody's like, oh, that was weird. Anyway, so about this squirrel, what's the significance of this squirrel?
No, I tried to play it up a little bit with the, ooh, is she a vampire? Is that what we're dealing with here? It was not actually meant to be a meta thing. It was Bug saying, oh, she's biting that thing's neck. What's going on there?
Yeah.
But,
those things are tough because it's hard to strike a balance between, like, I don't want to be overly dramatic about this thing that's happening, and at the same time, I don't want to be too subtle about it, and that line falls differently depending on the group that you're playing with, the situation that's going on at the time. You're in, mm-hmm. the middle of combat. Everybody's kind of going to glance over and go, did I see what I thought I saw?
Yeah, and being in combat was part of it. What I will say with Cindy is, and this isn't a criticism if you're listening, she injects a lot of those moments into, mm-hmm. to various things, and most of them are just filler flavor stuff. It's not meant to evoke, hey, I pull out, you know, tarts, going to my grandma's for some pies, or, you know, whatever. It's like, yeah, okay, that's your character thing. It's cool. Like, you know, you're doing that. It's flavor. We're not really involved or engaging with that at all. And by the fifth or sixth time it happens, maybe we're like, oh, she's doing that thing again. You know,
there's a disconnect between, and I see this. This is one of those things that I can identify with because I can see it from, on the one hand, it's like you're trying to do that improv thing of yes and. The problem is that you haven't done yes and, you've done thump, right? Like, there's no and, there's no, like, there's no invitation of reaction. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's tough to do that until you've practiced at it. None of us are really good at it. I'll say that.
I mean, the reality is like, it doesn't matter how good you are at it. Not everything's going to land either.
That's, you know, also true.
Yeah. Like the best comedians of the world get up on stage and bomb quite frequently. I don't think this particular thing with her transformation was one of those. She'd done it before, so I was just, it wasn't new this time. I think everybody else was kind of focused on the encounter because I was still down at that time. I might have been back up. I might have just come back up, but
yeah,
you know. So in combat, it's also kind of a, you know, well, it's not my turn. So what am I going to stop combat to have a conversation here? Do I want to save it for my turn? Or so I think in that particular instance, it's likely more what happened than, you know, nobody giving a shit.
No, I don't think that it was anybody. It was that people didn't give a shit. I think it was just that it wasn't like it was. I don't want to say the wrong time, but it was something that was injected and it came off like flavor, right? Like it wasn't inviting, but
yeah,
I'm glad that we had the discussion because I wasn't really sure how to address that. I'm like, yeah, I get that, but that's like a normal thing that happens in a D&D game.
Yeah. Right? And that's why I brought up the thing with your grandma's tarts and stuff like that. Cause it really did come across more like that than it did. Hey, I'm trying to give you a this is a teaser for the bigger story about my character or whatever, right? This is your the little hit that I'm slipping in. It definitely came across more like the narrative combat moment that you have where it's, you know, I brandish my sword and I glimmer in my eye and I bring it down on their skull with a bestial scream. Ah! The kind of thing that, you know, if you did it every turn, it'd annoy everybody. But when you break it out once in an encounter or something, it's totally fine.
Yeah. Like here's the dramatic moment where I do the thing where I shove a thing off the bridge or whatever.
Yeah.
Then I get it. I wonder if, there was something, this is a tangent. You could hit the stinger.
Tangent.
That needs to be a little bit more dramatic somehow, and I'm not sure how. Anyway, I found a thing, and this is not a parting gift, but it could fit there. A guy who does voice acting coaching, which is sort of interesting to get to. Did I subscribe to him? I can't remember, but there's these things called Laban Directions. Which sort of describe voices and how they work. I don't have the video. I'll have to send you the video at some point later, but it's interesting because he goes, the video that I saw that he did was sort of like how to do 100 voices. And I'm like, what? And it basically like there's 5 or 6 different ways that you can describe voices and they do make them slightly different, even without changing your tone, without changing like accents or pitch or any of that stuff. It's just how do you actually attack the words? And it's interesting to watch, and I've been trying to inject it into my game with voices. I don't know if I'm being 100% successful, but I mean, I do have it's nice because you can write down, here's what the character sounds like. Yeah, that was not nearly as interesting as I was hoping it would be when I pulled it out of my head. I'm like, because the video is really, really interesting and nice, to give you some direction about how to make characters as a DM, but me bringing it out has definitely fallen flat.
Well, after we're done here, kick me a link because I'm interested because I need to work on that kind of shit.
Yeah, it's neat because it's just like 5 different sort of toggles.
Is your bluster that you're doing with your village elder part of that?
Yes.
Okay. That's a particularly interesting one because it seems like you're doing a character, but because you kick off those sessions saying, this is going to be a clusterfuck. Because I'm not prepped and I've been working and I haven't slept and then you're blustering with the character and we're like, is this Telson or is this character? Well, no. When he stops talking and he starts describing instead of narrating, He's not blustering, so this must be the character, not Towson. But is it?
Well, at least it was subtle enough that it wasn't silly.
No,
so that's fine. Good. And there's one that I did with Coral too, but I'm almost certain I didn't pull that one off as well as I had hoped.
I'm not going to give anything away. I started making plans for the one shot that we're going to do your birthday weekend.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was going to do. I'm like, I got to figure out what I'm going to do. I don't want it to be super involved. Like, it's going to be a fun, you know, 4-hour kind of thing, but I want it to be entertaining at least. You know, I don't just want it to be, okay, there's a bunch of bad guys, roll some dice, let's get through a couple of combat encounters and call it a day. I want it to be something mm-hmm. other than that. And after about 3 hours of considering different things, the right idea hit me. And I am so, so excited about it.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to be the first D&D that I've played in person since before COVID.
Yep. Yeah, and I want to stick to just, you know, pencil, paper, rolling dice. I want to keep it completely offline. I'm not going to bring a bunch of books, so I'm sure I'll use my phone as a reference if I need to, but I'm actually going to load up my DM screen and
okay.
get as much shit as I need. Just, you know, stuff like remembering conditions, the kind of thing that even running games every week, 2 years later, I'm like, okay.
What does prone mean again?
Yeah.
Restrained is what?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to get that on there so that I'm not having to look at my phone too much during gameplay. I wasn't even going to use the DM screen, except I just need somewhere convenient to tuck that shit.
Yeah, DM screen is more often than not for me anyway. I was looking for a DM screen, by the way, for Foundry, and I didn't really find a good one. So I don't know if you have something that you use. I kind of wanted something that I could stick the characters on. And, you know, in retrospect, I'm thinking now that D&D Beyond is probably the appropriate thing to use for that. Maybe.
Yeah, honestly, I have that one module. I don't know if you've installed it yet, the quick insert search widget.
I don't think I have, no.
It's great because, like, I can just, you know, fuzzy search essentially, like I would use in one of my applications for development or stuff. Control space, start typing what it is I need to look for. So prone, it just fuzzy searches a list, and I just, boom, there's my tooltip for it. Drag and drop characters and stuff like that too. So just for some of the stuff you'd normally have on a DM screen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would do. Like if I'm running an encounter and you're talking about like having stat blocks up for character sheets and stuff like that, I don't. Sometimes I'll drag a bunch of them to the second screen, but for the most part, I'm just interacting with them through their tokens as I need to.
Well, I found, because one of the things that I needed to do specifically for this one was have a sort of reference to your hit points, because it was important. As much as it's often a terrorable thing that people hate, I mean, I do fudge dice rolls from time to time.
Oh, yeah, you gotta.
Because you have to. I mean, especially when you're throwing CR8 creatures at a level 3 party.
Well, that's why I asked. Like, when you attacked me the first time, it left me with 3 hit points after one hit. Then you attacked me again. You're like, oh, yes, you're definitely down. And I'm like, yeah. Okay, well, how much damage are you talking? Because I know it wouldn't take much for me to be out, right? Like, you yeah. literally one-shot me basically the first hit.
Yeah. It was a similar amount of damage the second time, but I'm like, no, it's not going to kill you, because that yeah. wasn't the point.
No,
I don't. There was, what was it? I'm sorry, I'm just scrolling through the add-ons that I've got. I have a thing called GM screen, but it's not compatible with version 11, so it has some issues. Mm-hmm. Right, in order to use pop out, you have to turn off the thing. It's great, except you can't pop it out unless you turn off the, I forget what they call it, but it basically docks on the bottom, mm-hmm. right? And then it takes up half your screen, but you can flip it up and down. But if you turn off the dock, the button to actually bring it up doesn't appear in version 11. Mm-hmm. And the guy who is maintaining it is like, it's not his job.
Yeah.
So he's behind on that. And that's fair. There was Party Overview was the one that I was using, and it's great, because really what I want is I want like an NPC style stat block for all the players,
mm-hmm.
And I just want a list of those in one window that I can put off to the side. And I can just look over and go, okay, so what is your status right now? Are you incapacitated? Are you held? Are you locked down? Are you targeted? You know, do you have one hit point left? Do you have full hit points? Right. I have the hit point bars up. Mm-hmm. But that's most of the time, like when I'm using a DM screen for whatever, even in tabletop, like I've hung not character sheets, but sort of character summaries on it. And when I do damage, I'll just go, okay, they're about half, they're about quarter, they're about whatever. And you know, in hairy combats, I have at times just asked players, how many hit points do you have left? Mm-hmm. Right. Because as much as hit points are not injuries in D&D, they're basically like, has your luck run out and they actually hit you with a blow that will take you down. You would still become a little bit more ragged as time went on.
Yes.
Right. So your enemies would be targeting you based on like, is this a person I can take out this round? And then I have one less person attacking me. They're probably going to attack the weakest party member most of the time if they're an intelligent creature. Mm-hmm.
Which incidentally, going back to fourth edition is one of the things that I absolutely carry forward into my games, like the bloodied condition.
Yes. Right?
I don't ask my players to announce it or anything, but I will, without saying literally bloodied, I try to, as you hit certain thresholds, provide descriptions for things that are happening to indicate that this guy is not in good shape. And my players generally reciprocate. And sometimes I will target specific ones because of it.
Yeah. Well, it just makes sense. It depends. Again, it depends on what kind of an enemy you're facing, right? You know, you're facing some weird cowardly guys. They're going to circle around and attack the weakest party member. You're fighting an evil paladin. Chances are he's going to stand toe to toe with your strongest character. Mm-hmm. You know, you're fighting a dragon. They're just going to strafe you with fire until you're all dead or what have you. Anyway, so that's the one thing that I'm currently finding lacking, and I'm struggling hard with the idea of I should just make my own. And that's a rabbit hole that is deeper than I want to go down. Mm-hmm.
7 hours later.
And we're back.
Oh my God.
We did the nerdiest thing ever and tangented into troubleshooting random technology problems, and an hour later.
Yeah, here we are.
We remembered, hey, weren't we recording a podcast?
I mean, kind of, yeah. Mostly we're just shooting the shit and recording it in case anyone's entertained. So if you're entertained, I mean, drop us an email at podbag@nerdingundertheinfluence.com.net.edu. I don't remember.
Hit us up on our OnlyFans.
There are days when I am comforted by the fact that somewhere out there on the internet, I am someone's fetish.
It's true.
Me and the goats.
At the same time?
Hey, well, you know, I've gotten older. I've experimented a little. Got to keep things interesting. I do. There's I talk about Behind the Bastards a fair bit. I was listening to another episode today where they were talking about the YouTube algorithm. And it's interesting how many YouTube engineers, former YouTube or Google engineers, have basically left the company and gone, oh my God, we need to raise the alarm. It's not the point. That was just me going, wow, I was shocked. I knew it was bad. Didn't know it was that bad. But he does this thing where they go to like ad breaks, right? And it's just like randomly things. And he'll do, and it's so awkward. But it's so awesomely awkward. Well, he just go, and we were talking about, terrible things that people have done. Here's some ads. That's great. Anyway, so we were talking about nerdy things, and then we did a nerdy thing, but we're going to edit that out and tangent back to that was the episode. We did it.
After this message from our sponsor, Manscaped. That's right. This message is about balls.
I specifically would love to do a Manscaped meal plan ad. You can order Manscaped meals in your mailbox, delivered once weekly. All of the broccoli will be shaved. The whole meal is just like shreds of Parmesan cheese because it's shaved. Or maybe it's shaved ham. I don't know. It's 100% prosciutto.
Well, no, because they've got skin safe technology on their lawnmower 4000. So you can cut close, but not shave your ham.
Oh my God.
Sign up now. Get your complimentary hedge trimmer. Manscaped.com/nutty. Use code word nutty. We are not sponsored. All right.
We are anti-sponsored. We're going to get a cease and desist letter. But seriously, if you do shave your balls, I mean, you know, use the product that works best for you. And please, God, don't cut them off.